Thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, Session 151, titled, Does Mormonism Have an Answer for Climate Change? Eco-Grief, Apocalypticism, and Mormon Environmental Rhetoric in the Anthropocene. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning at the end of August 2020. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation. Given the severity of climate change, its apocalyptic implications, and the growing trend of eco-grief, Mormon studies must engage with this issue more directly and openly. By using Wayne C. Booth's theories of rhetoric, our presenter hopes to determine how people across the Mormon spectrum communicate about this issue and understand it. Whether or not Mormon theology and culture has an answer for this global climate crisis, how those in Mormonism will be affected by this problem, and if our faith community can create enough resilience together to adequately address this impending disaster. I'll take a second to introduce you to our speaker before we begin. Shane Peterson is a Las Vegas Mormon who received a BA in English Literature at Brigham Young University. He currently lives in Seattle and is pursuing a PhD in language and rhetoric, researching environmental rhetorics in the era of climate change. I'll now give the floor to our presenter.
Hello. Thank you, Michael, for that introduction. Yes, I am currently broadcasting from Seattle, and I've been teaching at the University of Washington for about 4 years now. But now I'm teaching on Zoom University because everything was moved online last spring. So I obviously with Zoom, anything is possible. So if any errors come up, please let us know in the chat. Also, I want to make this presentation as interactive as possible. So if you have any comments, not just questions you want to submit, feel free to send comments either in the question or in the chat tabs throughout the presentation. And I will do my best to keep an eye on those and incorporate them and address them in the presentation as much as possible. So yes, I do consider myself to be a Las Vegas Mormon, even though I've since transitioned out of the church. And I obviously went to Brigham Young University and served a mission. But I found in my studies that oftentimes we don't necessarily address climate change as much as we should in Mormon discourse. So I grew up next to Lake Mead, which is the largest reservoir in terms of volume in the United States. But over the past couple decades, as a result of over-irrigation and climate change, with extensive droughts and rising global temperatures, the water levels in Lake Mead have dropped significantly, which in this picture has resulted in a large calcified white bathtub ring around the lake. I would say this is probably the first tangible material experience I had learning and experiencing how serious this crisis is and how it affects the places where I grew up. And that's something I would like you to consider up front. When did you first kind of encounter or realize what climate change is, how serious of a and pervasive of a problem it is, and how you kind of encountered or experienced the consequences of that or its manifestations? So with my guiding questions, how should we characterize Mormon rhetoric and what that word entails? Let's see. Also, so that's my first guiding question about Mormon rhetoric. Also, how does any form of rhetoric affect how we think or behave in relation to climate change? And what influence does Mormon rhetorics have on climate action in the Intermountain West? So I want to go back to some of the original definitions of rhetoric itself. Originally, with the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, he understood rhetoric as a methodology for finding every available means of persuasion and choosing the most fitting for that occasion. It relies on persuasion, or influencing and convincing an audience to change their beliefs, assumptions, attitudes, or behaviors in relation to a given issue or problem that a society or community shares together. And in a sense, religion and even science are inherently rhetorical in nature because of the amount of communication that occurs, how strategic that communication is for convincing others, and in terms of how it shapes others' worldviews. Because inherently, how we communicate and how we interpret, receive, and repurpose, recreate, other arguments and messages with others, this is what ultimately determines and shapes our worldviews. So I'm going to take you back to, I believe it was Writing 150 at BYU, or any English class that you might have taken with the rhetorical situation. You might have seen the model with the rhetorical triangle. But I like this model because it kind of displays the more fluid, dynamic aspects of rhetoric and how each of these factors actually overlap with each other. First, you have the writer or the speaker or what we call the rhetor, someone who is tapping into rhetoric to make some kind of argument. The subject that they're addressing, audience, the people they're speaking or writing to, but overlap, you know, over all that is the context. Who is discussing this? Where and when? Is this an issue which ties into exigence or why the writer is writing about a subject? What motivates them to address this topic? What the purpose is or what the audience is seeking from the audience themselves? Genre or the type of writing or speech or what have you, which determines how the subject is presented by the rhetor. And in the middle, in the center of all of this, is the text. That could be a speech, that could be an essay, that could be something more visual, like a poster. And according to contemporary theory, especially from Jacques Derrida, a text is any thing that communicates an idea or could be read as communicating something. Clothing could be a text, like a school uniform. Something more material, like a statue, also communicates some kind of argument, even if it's a bit more subtle and indirect, and not as crystal clear as, say, writing, like in a presentation. So I want to keep going back. I am going to bore you with some history, but I think it's important to cover some of these topics before to lay the groundwork moving forward. So Plato was one of Aristotle's contemporaries. In fact, he was Aristotle's teacher. Plato critiqued the study and field of rhetoric as being too sophistic or kind of relativistic. He believed in absolute immortal truths that could only be found through dialectic conversations using philosophy as a method. He found that rhetoric was too deceptive and could easily lead to tyranny in the worst of cases, or a misinformed, deceived, uneducated public that creates the possibility for the rise of tyrants and demagogues. And this is actually kind of a common critique and criticism of rhetoric. Plato claimed, instead of these kind of relativistic truths, or the truth as something that could be molded, someone complained about history. Ugh, so boring. I didn't come to Sunstone to learn about history. Suck it up, pal. This is what you're getting. Instead, Plato believed in eternal forms for everything, in that there is an ideal form to every object or idea, like beauty, that has always existed spiritually, whereas everything following that original copy is nothing but that, a copy. So for Plato, in this famous painting of the School of Athens, he, in this picture, is pointing up to the heavens because he believes that's where truth, with a capital T, can be found. His student, Aristotle, built on Plato's ideas, but disagreed with him in part. He believed that rhetoric was more amoral or neutral. It was just that, a tool that could be used for good or bad. And he believed that only by studying material reality here on Earth that we all collectively experience, that was the only way to come to some semblance of truth. It's important to cover and understand these distinctions because there has always been this kind of debate between science and religion, as well as truth versus relativism, or spirituality versus materiality, which are essentially Platonic ideas versus Aristotelian ideas, which manifests itself in many ways throughout Western history, leading up to the formation of the Latter-day Saint Church and climate change. We'll get to that. Now, obviously, Plato influenced a lot of religious thinkers and theologians who helped shape Western Christianity, especially the Catholic Church, including Saint Augustine of Hippo. He was trained in classical rhetoric in the Greco-Roman tradition before converting to Christianity and taking more of a critical stance toward rhetoric, despite the fact that he would write about using rhetoric to convert other people to Christianity or to teach them correct Christian principles. All of his ideas are largely based on Platonic ideas of eternal forms. And then, of course, you have St. Paul, who was also possibly trained in rhetoric and was a contemporary of the famous Roman rhetorician Quintilian. He used rhetorical techniques to convert so many people to the gospel. But he believed that rhetoric was inferior to the Spirit of God, which is what ultimately convinces others and leads them to the truth, not so much someone else, like a missionary, convincing others to join some kind of religion. As it talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 17, "For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be empty of its power." This has led to a long tradition of Christians teaching or critiquing rhetoric as a method or as a field of study, including Hugh Nibley, the famous Mormon scholar, famous for his work in Egyptology. I can't remember the specific quote, I couldn't find it, but I do remember him actually specifically listing rhetoric as an antithesis to gospel truths. If anyone can provide that quote or knows more about Hugh Nibley in that regard, please feel free to share. Let's think about Mormon rhetoric. And oh dear, looks like only half of my pictures are showing up. But you probably get the gist. When you think about Mormon rhetoric, what is used to convince others, think about General Conference, with President Russell Nelson speaking with authority, speaking on behalf for God. Or missionaries go out into the world to try to persuade others to join the church. Or social media campaigns like Light the World, which shares and circulates messages about the gospel with the intent of casting a certain image about the church, or trying to change people's minds about who Mormons are. Oh dear, and looks like post or ex-Mormon rhetorics is also not showing up. Shoot. But think about, say, the ex-Mormon subreddit. Think about, say, John DeLynn. Think about Sunstone in some regards as being post-progressive or ex-Mormon rhetorics in action. I'm going to skip some of this for the sake of time. One of the key issues with rhetoric is the concept of agency. As the LDS Church defines it, it is the ability and privilege of God that gives people the ability or capacities to choose and to act for themselves, a core doctrine that is pivotal to its most important myths, like the war in heaven and the Garden of Eden. It entails personal accountability versus the lack of freedom of choice as provided by Satan during the war in heaven. But agency is often a synonymous with freedom and liberty in most LDS contexts. Agency is also defined by rhetoricians, in contrast, as the capacity for any agent to act upon the conditions of a given situation and effect change through speech, writing, or other modes of communication. This involves creating meaning and changing the shared reality of within a certain community or even a larger ecology. But agency is unequally distributed throughout this larger network or rhetorical situation, but it can also be conscious or unconscious, human or non-human. Even animals, even non-material objects like statues or plants have some rhetorical force. And this complicates our notions of what individual agency is, which has become more tenuous in rhetorical scholarship. Which brings us to Wayne C. Booth, who has enjoyed a bit of a renaissance in with Sunstone listeners and spokesmen and podcasters. He was grew up in the early days of the church in the 1930s, before World War II. He served a mission in Chicago. He was allowed to attend philosophy classes at the University of Chicago and read philosophical works by Plato and others as he tried to learn about how to convince others about the validity and legitimacy of the church, but also as a means to explore his own doubts about the church. He came up with a theory, or several theories, about why people disagree and what can be done to create more generative, productive dialogue with others. One of the problems or challenges that people have in terms of agreeing about a given subject is often they adhere to what he calls dogmas of modernism that often conflict with each other. This could be scientism, which is a reliance on scientific fact as the only reliable form of truth. This is different than a system of belief or paradigm known as irrationalism, which is a reliance on assertions of belief based on personal convictions. This could be religious convictions or convictions about love or intimacy with others that we share. It doesn't necessarily have to be pejorative when I say irrational, but you see there are threads of Platonism versus Aristotelianism with these dogmas of modernism that people adhere to, which forces them at odds. To untangle this, he provided toward the end of his life and wrote in a Sunstone article, he called this theory rhetorology, which he developed to help analyze and mediate communication across difference. He understands it as a systematic ecumenical probing of the essentials shared by rival rhetorics in a given dispute. To do this, you would have to probe, trace, and analyze what are called topoi, or commonplaces as defined by Aristotle. These commonplaces are what participants of an exchange or a debate share together to find common ground and lead to more productive generative dialogue so that participants in that conversation can help each other come to some kind of consensus and work from there to create a common good. As he puts it, unlike skillful diplomats, rhetorologists do not just try to discover the rival basic commitments and then bargain, nor do they just tolerate in a spirit of benign relativism. Instead, they search together for true grounds, then labor to decide how those grounds dictate a change of mind about more superficial beliefs. Any genuine rhetorologist entering any fray is committed to the possibility of conversion to the enemy camp. Now, this sounds all well and good, and this is something he definitely thought a lot about toward the end of his life. Granted, this theory of rhetorology has not necessarily been picked up by a lot of contemporary rhetorical scholars or researchers. One of the challenges or critiques of this theory could be, well, what about more insidious rhetorics from more hostile enemy camps, such as climate skeptics, such as racism, such as right-wing extremists? And we'll get to that, as we'll see, with the climate crisis. So think about how all of these topics deal with climate change and the severity of this crisis. What are the differing rhetorics surrounding this issue, and why does it matter? In some regards, a lot of the importance of this issue goes without saying, unless you've been living under a rock for the last 4 years. So, environmental rhetorics are rhetorics that address topics related to the natural environment and issues related to environmentalism. But largely these rhetorics draw from larger religious or spiritual traditions when making arguments about the necessity for caring for the planet or how we are interconnected with the planet and other living species like the flora and fauna. You hear phrases like Mother Earth, which it draws from a lot of spiritual, even indigenous traditions, or you see in a lot of Christian discourses and communities citing religious scripture. Or environmental rhetorics could evoke apocalyptic themes when addressing the devastating consequences of not solving environmental problems, which in the modern kind of environmental movement in the United States was very much the modus operandi of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Environmental rhetors also see themselves as almost like prophets, watchmen on the tower, seeing their expertise about scientific fields or environmental studies, they see this impending problem, whether with pesticides, whether with drought, over irrigation, or human-driven climate change, and try to warn people about the coming disaster. You don't see a lot of environmental, quote-unquote environmental rhetoric in the Book of Mormon, aside from how the Lord has created the earth, which is very familiar with the New Testament. But in the Doctrine and Covenants, you see more of this idea concerning environmental stewardship, about how how the saints should care for the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air, and it is not given that man should possess everything on it or exploit others unfairly, because therein lies sin. And according to the Doctrine and Covenants, we will be held accountable for our actions and how we deal or treat the natural environment. But we'll dig into that a little more and how that might be used in inadvertently destructive ends. And why does rhetoric and communication matter for the climate crisis? According to this quote from Dan Zak from the Washington Post, The climate problem is not just scientific, it's linguistic. If we can agree how to talk and write about an issue that affects us all, maybe we can understand and fix it together. So, really briefly, one way, or one recent theory that has been commonplace in the humanities, rhetorical studies, and even literary studies is trying to understand the climate crisis through the lens of what's called the Anthropocene, which is a newly proposed geological epoch in which human beings have left a large enough footprint on the planet that will become a permanent part of the geological record. This takes into account not just, say, global warming and rising temperatures or the greenhouse effect from carbon emissions, but also other factors like mass extinctions, rising sea levels, radiation from nuclear tests, the dispersion of plastic particles that will remain and become fossilized. And what are the products, or how did these markers in the geological record become permanent? Usually through different systems of power, means of production, or other human global phenomena, such as carbon capitalism or imperialism, that has created this widespread culture of industrialism, especially with the great acceleration in the early 20th century. That has led to the rise of carbon emissions through fossil fuels and rising temperatures. In order to untangle all of these interconnected phenomena, we have to use multiple fields of study, methodologies, and theory, academic theories from history to economics to sociology to climatology, psychology, philosophy, rhetoric, and religion. And the Anthropocene, or viewing the Anthropocene as part and parcel with the climate crisis, helps us understand the severity and consequences of this problem. Anthropomorphic human climate change has resulted in devastating losses to a vast majority of the planet's biodiversity, as well as economic devastation of disappearing agricultural and crumbling infrastructure, as well as widespread violent conflicts over basic human resources like food and water. Think about the Syrian civil war. A lot of climatologists argue and claim, based on some pretty convincing evidence, that that armed conflict and the ensuing refugee crisis was in part a result of extensive droughts in that region that displaced so many people and led to these armed conflicts over dwindling resources. And a grim view of the climate crisis is this rising possibility of armed conflict and displacement of millions of people worldwide, which is why recently the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has warned that if we don't make drastic changes now, then we will face the possible collapse of human civilization perhaps as soon as 2050, at the very least, widespread untold human suffering on a biblical scale. Oh, I need a drink after that. Be warned, this topic is a downer, because many of these impacts will result or manifest themselves differently according to different regions. Think about the Mormon Corridor. Think about the Intermountain West. Climatologists have recently designated the extensive decade-long drought in the American Southwest as a mega drought, the first in a millennium ever since the Middle Ages. This can also result in severe water shortages across the region, as evidenced by the drastic drops in water levels in large bodies of water like Lake Mead and the Colorado River. The problem with this is that multiple states and metropolitan areas, from Las Vegas to Phoenix to Los Angeles, all rely on the Colorado River and Lake Mead for water and electricity because of the Hoover Dam. But what happens when those bodies of river run dry? Then you could result in the American Southwest being uninhabitable as a result of desertification, extensive drought, food shortages, increased wildfires, and disruptions to already fragile ecosystems. So, we have seen a rise in apocalyptic rhetoric in the discourse of environmentalism. Others have warned that apocalypse will become the new normal moving forward, and others argue we have already passed the tipping point. There's nothing could be done. Climate catastrophe and climate extinctions are now inevitable. I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, but this is just Roy Scranton's words. According to his book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, we are fucked. It's probably over. Something we may have to contend with is that climate extinction is inevitable. How do we contend with that? And what are the implications for religious faith, especially the Mormon faith? Okay, let's continue up into more depressing territory. Taking a step back. Apocalypse originally means revelation in original Greek. It now refers to major disasters or cataclysms that transition the old world to the new, or reveals flaws in a society that helped cause this collapse to begin with. This draws from a larger body of work called eschatology, a branch of theology that studies how different religions or cultures envision the end times, and how humans understand the history of humanity, largely as being linear or as a narrative, with larger cosmological forces being the authors. The problem that climate change presents is that it denies the agency of these cosmological forces and puts the blame of climate change on humankind. Or complicates the notion of what humans can do about this problem. We can understand apocalypse as local, recurring, disruptive, and revelatory. So let's think about what the climate crisis reveals for the Mormon Church. For the sake of time, I am going to have to skip over some topics to get to how this reveals, or what this reveals about the human, not just humankind, but the Mormon Church in particular. Actually, I would say that the Smith family, they were originally climate refugees. In the infamous Year Without a Summer in 1816, from the eruption of Mount Tambora, which created a large cloud of volcanic smoke that caused global temperatures to drop and disrupted agriculture across the North American continent, including Vermont, where the Smith family originally lived. And according to his mother, Joseph Smith's family had to move from Vermont to New York because of crop failures. So in many ways, Mormonism is a product of a climate crisis, of massive changes in the climate. Think about that, especially when we get to what makes this problem difficult to contend with. One challenge is that Mormon culture is full of climate skepticism as a result of conservative discourses and rhetorics from people like President Ezra Taft Benson, Cleon Skousen, and more recently, Glenn Beck. Benson was critical of the environmental movement and called Rachel Carson a communist, which he used pejoratively and almost to signal as she is an agent of a larger satanic conspiracy. Skousen also bought into this paradigm and argued for the abolition of the Environmental Protection Agency. and opening up public lands for private interests. Glenn Beck, on his show, was also a big proponent of the debunked ClimateGate conspiracy theory, claiming that climate scientists were being paid off by the government to overblow this issue as a means to deny average American citizens their rights and their liberties to the land that they work and live on. For example, the Bundy case started, the Bundy standoffs from 2014 were a result of disputes over lands being public lands in Nevada being restricted to protect the endangered species, the desert tortoise. But Bundy, Cliven Bundy, wanted to graze on those lands illegally, even though cattle are very destructive species and aren't fit for the fragile ecosystems and arid lands of the American West. So when the Bureau of Land Management came in and confiscated his cattle, the Bundy family, decided to raise a militia, which led to an armed standoff with the feds. They ultimately decided to stand down. Bundy decided to, was able to confiscate and regain his cattle. But a couple of years later, this led to the Oregon standoff in the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Hammond County, Oregon. This is where the church finally spoke up. Despite all their long history of anti-federal discourse and anti-environmentalism, they disagreed with the Bundy's actions and said that it cannot be justified by Mormon scripture. There are a lot of counter-arguments to this based on what people like President Benson have said, but you see this shift from the church as it becomes a larger global entity. And as a result, we kind of get to why that might be a problem. The Mormon church is a large economic and political system now. Other climate advocates and scholars like Amitav Ghosh have said that organized religions are not restricted by carbon economies and can circumvent those entanglements and become bigger and more powerful forces to create more positive change and progress to prevent climate change. However, I have to disagree, and I argue that the Mormon Church, the Brighamite Latter-day Saint branch, is a perfect example of why this can't always be the case. Compare some of the rhetorics from the Mormon Church to the Laudato Si from Pope Francis, which is more direct in saying that climate change is a problem, is a result of larger industrial economies, and also entails issues related to climate justice, not just protecting the environment. He actually recommends specific apology recommendations. It's a long document, but it's very extensive, as opposed to a statement from the LDS Church about environmental stewardship and conservation. It does not mention climate change. It adheres more to the logic of stewardship, which treats land as property, even if it's God and we're merely the stewards, but we can use those resources however we see fit. And it does not get specific in terms of policy, and shifts the responsibility from larger global institutions or corporations to individual members, putting the onus on them to recycle more. Even though every climate scientist, scholar, and activist says we cannot rely on just individual action to address climate change, that requires widespread societal policy changes, legislation, new laws being passed, and decarbonizing and taxing fossil fuel industries and larger corporations that rely heavily on fossil fuels. So we have to think about what is the future of Mormonism in the midst of climate change, or what should its future be? How much of the brunt of responsibility lies on Mormonism to address climate change in the Intermountain West? But we come up with the majority of problems, which I'm going to lay out here for the sake of time. And these are challenges or potential reasons why the LDS Church probably won't take meaningful, effective, ethical measures to address climate change that I'll list here. And feel free to disagree or counter-argue back and forth during Q&A. So, number one, the church's stance on environmental stewardship still adheres to the Christian notion of hierarchy of species in which humans maintain dominance over other forms of life on Earth, being divinely mandated to use the Earth's resources for our own ends. Effective climate action dismantles this hierarchy of species that's a legacy of the Great Chain of Being and the Western Christian tradition, but that's something that's very much still a part of Mormon theology, especially considering we're not just another species on this planet. We are children of God. We are gods in embryo, as opposed to the critters and the other living things on the earth. They are still beneath us. Also, number two, the church still has a deeply invested investments in fossil fuel industries and other economic sectors with large carbon emissions. For example, they own the largest cattle operation in the United States in the state of Florida. They invest so much in real estate, transportation, and other technological sectors that still rely on non-renewable forms of energy. Divesting from that can be very expensive, and it would require them to give up a large part of their wealth, including the $100 billion they are now sitting on. But the church, number three, the church has always been an embodiment of American capitalism and the prosperity gospel writ large, which is arguably some of the largest forces that have helped create the climate crisis to begin with. Capitalism is not a aspect of this climate problem. Capitalism is the problem. And the church would have to move away from being a capitalistic institution. Number four, it has always been adamant about amassing and maintaining wealth at any cost. And that $100 billion reserves is reserved for the second coming. They're not going to distribute that at any time soon, despite the fact that a lot of experts claim that addressing the climate crisis effectively and overhauling our economy and decarbonizing would cost about $300 billion. A large part of that could come from a donation from the church. But that would be a very big expense and would cause them to try to give up on this nest egg that they are very, very key on maintaining. Number five, reducing or cutting any and all carbon emissions, such as sending thousands of missionaries abroad via plane, transporting general authorities to other nations, or building multiple temples, would require the church to drastically reduce its own growth and would limit a lot of the logistical day-to-day affairs of the church itself. Think about how many hours you have spent in the car because of the church, going to Mutual, going to scout camps, going to the temple, driving your missionary son or daughter to the MTC and back, putting them on a plane. How much of a carbon footprint have you helped create because of your activity in the church? Think about it. Decarbonizing completely, which is the only way to address this crisis, would require us to give up so many of those day-to-day LDS activities. Number six, theologically and culturally, the church has always been about infinite growth and kingdom building as manifest in its core beliefs and most sacred practices performed and promised in the temple, worlds without end. Many LDS practices, behaviors, and rituals rely on that outlook of infinite growth, whereas climate change requires sustainable living, which requires us to live with less, which is not something that is going to be easy to do if you are a practicing Mormon, and something institutionally the church will have to struggle with. Also, number seven, they would have to contend with this widespread culture of anti-federalism in the church and across the Mormon corridor that has always been anti-environmental or skeptical of climate change. And also, number eight, these anti-federalist, anti-socialist, ultra-Orthodox, and fundamentalist discourses within Mormonism have created the probability of militia violence, as evidenced by the Bundy standoffs, or even schisms from the church. The church risks breakoffs if they fully commit to climate action. Also, number nine, effective and ethical measures addressing climate change would require advocacy for indigenous rights and ecological practices from those communities, even though this is an issue that the church has become silent on and is perhaps ashamed of because of the racism inherent in the core narrative of the Book of Mormon and abusive practices that were pervasive throughout the Lamanite placement program. This is something that the church does not want to talk about. Number 10, reorienting itself to align with the interests of environmental advocacy or activism would put the church in a difficult position rhetorically as well as economically. They would have to reverse hundreds of years of anti-environmentalist and imperialist discourses and apologize for those actions and do a complete 180, even though the church is in no position rhetorically to apologize for just about anything. As soon as you say past prophets and apostles and leaders who speak for God are wrong, it raises some doubts about whether or not those brethren are capable of speaking for God. Number 11, the traditional Mormon beliefs on apocalypticism requires God to be in control or the cause of these world-ending events or the agent that will save the faithful, which runs counter to the narratives of climate change and obliterates human individual agency. You can store as much winter wheat in your basements as you want, but climate change is a slower death. There is nothing that can prepare you for that complete collapse in the societal structures we rely on for food, for water, for energy, etc. And for a lot of people like myself, we've come to the realization that perhaps there will be no Calvary coming in over the hill. If Christ doesn't come, what would that mean for those Mormon faithful believers who are still hanging on for dear life? Imagine that future for a second. And number 12, historically, the church has always been many years behind each progressive cause, such as the priesthood ban against Black members in 1978 and toning down its anti-gay rhetoric in recent years. They're always behind on a lot of these progressive causes. Why should climate change be any different? All right. I know I went on a rant there. I am passionate about this topic. I am pessimistic as well. And I'm afraid that I am the person who believes that meaningful action on climate change has to come from individual members, meaning you will have to raise this issue in Sunday school, in sacrament meeting, with your bishops, with your local leaders. This means we may have to create a climate march that directly goes to church headquarters, to their doorstep, and asks, what is the LDS church going to do about this crisis? And expect an answer from them. This would require us to create more resilient local communities and would require us to almost restructure our wards, our support groups to address the contingencies of this crisis. There is some hope. There are some elements of LDS doctrine and theology that could help create this more communal, sustainable ways of living with laws of consecration that was practiced during the frontier period, perhaps recasting or advancing the Heavenly Mother figure as a figure for taking care of the earth in radical ecological ways. There is a possibility for creating and interconnecting indigenous traditions, feminist and queer theories with environmental rhetorics and Mormon theological beliefs. And I recommend if you want to address this problem head on, you would have to take a more radical approach to LDS theology and their theology on stewardship. We should not be stewards. We are members of this worldwide ecosystem. We are not above any other living thing. We have to address, we have to acknowledge and respect the agency and rhetorical capacities of the non-living world we live in, which would require us to think twice about buying a new car, going on an airplane so much. And it may require us to talk about, should this move to a digital format for Sunstone be permanent? Should we rethink not having people come, you know, fly all the way to Salt Lake in large quantities to speak at Sunstone? Even after the quarantine is over, should this be a permanent fixture if we want to reduce our own individual carbon footprints and think about how Sunstone can be an organization and a platform for climate activism here in the Intermountain West, here in the Mormon community? I'm done. Thank you. So let's address some questions. And God, this is a heavy topic, isn't it? So feel free to submit some questions. Let's see. How do you see environmental art fitting into rhetoric and persuasion about the climate crisis? Yes, visual rhetoric also applies to art, paintings, murals. There's also a rising trend of climate art or activist public art with graffiti, with murals on walls in public spaces. There are avenues for those type of actions. Any genre is fair game for this kind of activism. Let's see. Rhetoric being weaponized is a complicated issue. Is fighting rhetoric with opposite rhetoric an effective strategy? Good question. And that's why Booth was concerned with this issue and why it often requires us to rethink what we've been taught in high school or in college about rhetoric being about debate, about winning, about beating the opponent, like rhetorical strategies as if we're at war with others. But a lot of feminist rhetoric scholars claim that we need to rethink that. And the good thing with rhetorology, it requires us not to meet opposing rhetoric with more opposing rhetoric, but to listen. To listen and then find common ground, and from there, find avenues where we agree, come to a consensus, and then come up with ways that we can work on certain shared problems together. For example, in Oregon, some ecologists have been able to work with ranchers to address dwindling resources with overgrazing or over-irrigation, not so much by talking about climate change, but talk about drought. Conservative ranchers may not want to talk about climate change, but they'll talk about drought because they understand what it's like if there's less water to be had. So think about that when talking about this issue with your ward members and other fellow co-religionists. Okay, how do you see environment, or we already touched on that. Let's see. Recognized. Actually, I think that's about it. And I think we're just about out of time. Oh, let's see.
One Shane, more.
Yeah?
My version of the schedule has us going a half hour. It shows on my version that this runs till 3 o'clock Mountain Time.
And oh, let's see. It's 2:30, right?
Right. So we have more time for questions if you have time. And I don't know if they're showing up on your view, but There are several more that I can see.
Okay.
Do you want me to read some?
Yeah, go ahead. I've been talking for too long.
Give yourself a rest for a moment. One, just in no particular order, one person asks, could these points of climate action for the church be sold to the institutional church as good PR?
Possibly. The issue is, again, they have to consider their core membership. They have to consider not just, you know, more liberal progressive members who might be vocal about this issue, but more conservative members as well. Oftentimes, rhetorically, the church, when talking about sensitive issues with race, with their history of colonialism, or even issues with the history, like with, say, the authorship of the Book of Mormon or polygamy, they don't want to be in a position where they give the impression that, again, past prophets and apostles were wrong in any way. And that's why they haven't been very vocal about saying communism and socialism is not as evil as Cleon Skousen or Benson have made it out to be. Because as a worldwide church now, they also have to consider, well, we have a lot of members in socialist countries, like in Scandinavia. So that's why they don't necessarily try to do a complete 180 in a lot of the past positions they have taken. Oftentimes, they'll just try to de-emphasize. And in terms of PR, with addressing the climate crisis, that was very much inherent in their statement that they put out with environmental stewardship. They try not to be so direct about climate change because they understand that so many of their members are still climate skeptics. And they don't want to alienate those members. If you read the statement, which we could have time for, if you read it in depth, again, they don't address the crisis head on. They tiptoe around it.
On a related kind of note, one person says, perhaps we should add callings for this work. Do you have a thought about that?
I think that would be important moving forward. Yes, possibly in terms of creating resilience among our local communities, we can think about how ward callings can be take on the responsibilities and duties of, say, reducing the carbon footprint of the ward houses and the wards we are a part of. We could have a ward, a sustainable living specialist that talks about, goes to members of the ward and asks them, what are you doing to recycle more? What are you doing to replacing your light bulbs with ones that don't consume as much energy? What can we do, Bishop Johnson, what can we do to reduce our chapel's energy bill? That could be a calling. Or that could be rethought in terms of, I know they're not called home teachers anymore, what are they called?
That's terrible. My mind has gone blank.
Yeah, but yeah, those ministering. Yes.
Yeah, ministering.
Ministers, that could be part of their responsibility if, say, food prices go up as a result of agriculture being devastated by climate change.
That thought seems consistent with the idea of having an employment specialist, for example.
Yes, absolutely.
If it were cast in the right framework, it might not be so objectionable to the people who are more in the climate denier camp.
And that's why, again, like, we can't just think of it in terms of how do we rework the current framework. We have to think about how do we try to engage with climate skeptics in our ward houses, in our sacrament meetings. How do we bring this issue up in sacrament meetings? This would require us to think about what are the approaches we can take in ways that aren't alienating, that aren't too aggressive. Again, maybe don't start with climate change. maybe instead talk about sustainable living. Spiritual ecological practices. Interpreting and arguing for interpretations from Doctrine and Covenants that promote sustainable living. Take, for example, the Word of Wisdom. You can absolutely justify transitioning from a predominantly meat-based diet to a plant-based diet using the Word of Wisdom with the phrase, eat meat sparingly or only in times of famine. You can justify becoming a vegan, which you should consider, if you want to reduce your carbon footprint.
Coincidentally, I've seen a Facebook group that does just that. They're promoting healthier eating based on the Word of Wisdom to incorporate those ideas. In a similar kind of framework, one person asks, in most cases, religion, read dominionism, is the most stalwart opponent to climate change science. Can religion be utilized to form sensible climate actions?
Yes. However, the problem again is how is religion and religious activism politicized, or how is it interpreted as being political? You can absolutely advocate for radical activism by adhering more to the original figure of Christ and his practices in the New Testament. The problem is in American Christianity, in the Christian communities of the Republican Party that are predominantly climate skeptics, they have cast Christ as more of a Orthodox figure that's more about, say, the obedience to the letters of the law, about adhering to Christ's word or the scriptures. But you can absolutely read and interpret Christ as being a radical activist, as someone who was trying to disrupt the local economies and destructive practices of his day, such as with overturning the money-changing temples or money-changing tables at the temple, which you can use to also justify protests that are disruptive, that might contain defacing or destroying public property as a means to give a voice to the voiceless, which we have seen with the Black Lives Matter protests. And I would have to say that if we truly want to disrupt carbon, the fossil fuel industry, to disrupt the geopolitical forces and institutions that are killing the planet, it's not enough just to march in the streets and hold a sign. Frankly, we're going to have to consider breaking some shit. We can't just take to the streets. We have to stay in the streets. If you want to justify that through scripture, look no further than what Christ did when he cast out the money changers in the temple.
In a push and pull kind of thing, on a biblical scale, you mentioned at one point that phrase, isn't the end of the world what most Christian faiths look forward to?
That is the problem, and that is why so many conservative groups like the Bundys or other just mainstream, say, Republican Mormons don't necessarily want to act on climate change or don't feel like we should take radical action, even if they accept it as a reality, because they anticipate the inevitability of the world, of the world's destruction. They view fixing the crisis, like the climate crisis, as futile because the world's going to end anyway, but then Christ is going to come in and renew the planet into some kind of new Eden. So that's why they're often, if not hostile or antagonistic to environmental initiatives, they're at least hesitant, or just frankly what's the word? I'm blanking. Just resistant to any idea to addressing it. So that's something, a problem that a lot of environmental movements have to deal with. The fact that we're not trying to help bring about the world's ending, we want to prevent a version of this apocalypse. But the problem is, Mormon conceptions of apocalypse conflict with climate apocalypse. We need to act to prevent climate apocalypse, but like you said, Mormons would welcome climate apocalypse, but they view the apocalypse as being something completely different or a different manifestation of it. For them, this will be, if you read apocryphal accounts of the Second Coming, this will entail civil war, the rise of tyranny in the United States, World War III, nuclear war, not so much about, say, slow ecological disasters that will take decades to unfold. Mormons view the apocalypse happening very quickly. A thief in the night, the world ending with a bang. But to quote T.S. Eliot, according to climate scientists, the world will end in, or human civilization as we know it, will end with a whimper. It's going to be a slow death. And that's why often we have to contend with these different theoretical underpinnings and understandings of what is apocalypse. And why are some apocalyptists are ignoring the apocalypse that is staring us right in the face, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Another person writes, I'm troubled by the cohesion rhetoric creates. Climate skeptics often identify many other conspiracy, often identify with many other conspiracy-minded ideologies and are often religious. Do you have thoughts?
Yes, and that is something I've been researching in my dissertation. A lot of, say, Mormon conservatives, especially during the Cold War, adhere to this paradigm of McCarthyism, of seeing communists behind every progressive liberal initiative, public figure, or act, you know, instance of rhetoric. For example, Ernie Wilkinson, a BYU president in the 70s, created a network of students that he required to have them report to him if they felt like some of their more left-leaning professors were potentially communists or communist sympathizers, which of course was predominantly in the humanities, in sociology or philosophy. And that's why you see a lot of conspiratorial thinking, especially in the rhetoric of, say, Ezra Taft Benson. A lot of that is stemmed from Mormon scripture, like the Book of Mormon, Gadient and Robbers, or secret combinations. For a lot of Mormons, environmentalists are a part of a secret combination to bring about some kind of overthrow of the U.S. government, because they see communism as ultimately satanic, as the methodology and the force, as the army that Satan is building at a material and metaphysical level. And again, that framework, that kind of mode of thinking is very much baked into the Book of Mormon in its narrative.
Grassroots pressure from within is one aspect of bringing about change. What are some governmental policies that would push the church to reform on climate?
Any kind of carbon tax or policies reining in real estate development, but also fossil fuel industries and even the cattle industry. I brought up how the church owns a large ranch in Florida called Deseret Ranches. We would have to consider enacting legislation that will restrict the growth of the cattle industry and place harsher restrictions on where they should graze and find ways, either policy-wise or economically, public infrastructure, et cetera, on how do we make eating meat no longer a mainstay of the American diet. The cattle industry has been pivotal in passing policies about land use in the American West in ways through lobbying, through deceptive, abusive practices that have led to problems of overgrazing in lands that are supposed to be protected from these fragile ecosystems. I'm very much trying to eliminate beef from my diet, and I'm very critical of the cattle industry after spending a summer researching how they have created a lot of these ecological problems in the American West, because cows are not native to the American Southwest or even the American mainland. Bovine are better suited for the rich green lands of Europe, but we brought them over and they pretty much replaced the American buffalo, which almost went extinct. Instead, there are now millions upon millions of cattle in the United States because there's a massive demand for it economically. And the cattle industry have become so powerful that they have been able to push land use policies that favor their economic interests. That has created massive greenhouse gas emissions. The cattle industry is largely responsible for a lot of greenhouse gas emissions globally, I think a third actually, as well as not just in terms of the methane gas cows fart out, but also the cattle industry is largely responsible for deforestation. The forest fires in the Amazon from last year were largely driven from cattle businesses. So I would say that would be one place to start, actually, or something we need to consider. And again, that's why I think the church is hesitant to decarbonize or to take drastic action, because then it would require us to think, to require them to think about, well, what about Deseret ranches? Because the purpose of that ranch is to create a food source when everything goes to hell during the second coming. But part of the kind of the mind fuck I've been dealing with as a researcher is thinking about, well, to what extent is the Mormon mindset and culture of food storage almost warranted because of the possible food shortages or even widespread famines as a result of the climate crisis? Is my father in the right for maintaining a 5-year food storage? Should we keep a hold on Deseret Ranches and the granaries across the Salt Lake Valley? Because we will kind of need it for this apocalypse. I kind of went off a tangent there. Forgive me.
One person writes, when a hurricane is on the shore, you don't reason with a tantruming child. You drag them out of the path of destruction. When do climate scientists cut climate deniers out and be the adults?
Now is a good time as any. Something we should consider, again, rhetorically, is when finding common ground, when debating, when having a conversation, when should we deny certain positions or groups or interests a platform? When should we not even engage? This has been critical for fighting white supremacy, such as taking down white supremacist or extremist accounts on Twitter or on YouTube. Facebook has been behind on that, but also Google. Part of this fight would be, and policy would also be, trying to create policy that will be stricter about denying and restricting hate speech online, which may have to also deal with denying platforms to people who spread misinformation, such as with the coronavirus. Despite free speech, spreading misinformation about coronavirus is a public health risk. People can die because they feel like we don't need to be vaccinated. I don't have to wear a mask because of X, Y, and Z, et cetera, which none of the scientific community is behind. Same thing with climate change. We should consider the fact that climate change is a public health crisis. People will die because of it. So to what extent should we deny climate deniers a platform? Online or elsewhere? And again, this would require us to kind of have a different approach in terms of rhetoric. And this is where Wayne C. Booth's rhetorology would not come into play. Because that's been something I've been thinking about. The limits of Booth's theory of rhetorology is, when do we not even engage in with other rhetorics that are hostile and harmful?
Thank you. There are three questions that really tap into different aspects of the same thing. So let me read each of them. Climate change, biodiversity loss, and so forth are rarely, if ever, mentioned in conference on any level. Mm-hmm. Is the church missing out on its prophetic role by not addressing the most important problems or crises related? Is the view of the imminence of the second coming of one of the reasons that's blocking us as a church to take more decisive action? After all, Jesus is returning soon, and we'll sort it all or clean things out. And third, why would the church even try to mitigate climate change? It plays right into their end time story in Second Coming, right?
Right. But again, you have to think about what has been said before, what is still being circulated from Benson, from Skousen. If they say that, yes, climate change is the apocalypse, or how the Second Coming and the signs of the times will play out, that is a counter-narrative or runs counter to everything that was circulated during the Red Scare, during the Cold War. And that invalidates what previous prophets have said, that have argued that, no, the apocalypse is not going to be through climate change, it's going to be through communism. So that does put the church in a difficult position. And also, I would say that you see less and less prophetic statements being brought up in conference because the church has learned from previous failed prophecies that they can't put themselves in that position rhetorically, because what if they're proven wrong? Or if the future unfolds in ways that you can't necessarily predict, such as when, I believe it was Joseph F. Smith said, we will never go to the moon. That's something that they don't, that's a position rhetorically they don't want to put themselves in ever again. This, which is why I don't think you're going to see President Nelson say, the Lord has spoken to me and we must as a church decarbonize, because this is the vision of the future, is the climate crisis, is mega droughts in the Southwest. Hopefully that answers at least some of those questions.
Yes, thanks. Someone asks, pardon me, my house phone's ringing. What would it take to have a pilot program at the stake level?
That would require enough people to come to the stake president to say, we want to create this committee. A committee that addresses environmental stewardship, sustainable living, and it would require enough interest at a stake level. A lot of the programs in the church that are vibrant, that have created a sense of community and cohesion throughout ward communities, have started at local levels, and then the Salt Lake Church has taken it up, correlated, and made it official. It has almost always been with Relief Society, with Mutual, with Sunday School. It has often been a result of that time in church history during like the 60s and 70s when wards were more like local cultures. But then the church came in and created widespread Sunday school curriculums and co-opted, you know, the Relief Society, and created it, you know, co-opted it as a church-wide function worldwide. That's why I say this interest, this dialogue has to be from the ground up, from that grassroots level of, yes, enough people need to come to the stake president and say, we want to create this committee, which would look like X, Y, and Z, depending on people's interests, specialties, the needs of the ward, based on where they're at, geographically speaking, etc.
Thank you. There's another person who asks kind of a nuanced question. For me, the term steward of the earth instills a sense of personal responsibility to, rather than one of dominance over the earth. Do you think that the idea of stewardship is inherently problematic, or is it the fact that church leaders aren't advocating for responsible, sustainable stewardship as a sacred responsibility?
I would say that's kind of both, in a sense, because I find the term stewardship problematic because the original definition of the word steward means a caretaker on behalf of a property owner. We are stewards for the land or for the environment on behalf of God who owns the earth that he created. But that still adheres to the notion that the environment is property. So instead of not doing any kind of mining or, you know, cattle ranching, et cetera, which would be required for, you know, completely decarbonizing, they still adhere to, we need to take care of the planet, but we can also use the planet's resources at the same time. That's not an ecological viable mode or environmental policy. And also, stewardship is inherently a patriarchal framework, inherently masculine, with cattle ranchers and cowboys, landowners being predominantly white and male. It still has a lot of threads historically, politically, economically, etc., with these larger harmful systems of power like white supremacy, like misogyny, like patriarchy. I think we actually need to deconstruct and come up with new terms. And that's something that feminist theory, queer theory can help us deconstruct. A big reason why in a lot of indigenous cultures, you see Mother Earth being a female. Maybe Heavenly Mother can be that stand-in in the Mormon tradition, which would require us to rethink what steward is or means or how it's used in the LDS tradition. You think I'm just debating this one word like a nerd, which I am, but it's necessary for how people think and how they behave, because that's the power that rhetoric has. That's why we need to have these critical conversations.
Thank you. There are a few questions that, well, there were more statements. One, and most of these I've hidden just because they weren't questions. I'm trying to track them. But one I thought you would enjoy is someone objects to the idea of Sunstone being only online. That would inconvenience them. another one, electrical.
Deal with a lot of inconveniences if we want to live with less and start to decarbonize. That would mean driving less or even think about not just doing away with the driving, but also doing away with flying altogether, which is something a lot of hardcore environmental advocates are trying to do, and something they recommend others at least consider doing. Yes, it's inconvenient. Yes, talking over Zoom sucks sometimes, but it's just something we're going to have. It's sacrifices we're going to have to be willing to make. Decarbonizing radical environmental action requires sacrifice. The question is, what do we sacrifice?
And one of the other statements, I'm an electrical engineer. Carbon emissions can be reduced by replacing internal combustion engine vehicles with electric power transportation and the electrical power generated through zero emission generation, such as solar and wind. The solar farms just outside of Las Vegas have more generating capacity than nearby Hoover Dam. Interesting.
That's a good place to start, yes. And that's something that I think needs to be an investment in terms of moving to more renewable resources as the source of our energy, especially in the Southwest, especially in the Mormon Corridor, is replacing a lot of coal plants with solar power. I read an article recently about how the Hoover Dam can be converted to a giant solar panel plant, or changing some of the turbines to wind turbines. That kind of I'm blanking here, but that kind of, there it is. Innovation is necessary in order to make this transition, not just as a church, but as a larger society.
Thank you. Our time's pretty well up. I'd like to thank you all for attending and for supporting Sunstone. And I look forward to seeing you at the next session.